have to be careful when I turn on my microphone to stop singing, because I like to sing and things like that, and Robert's a good song leader. I am not a good song leader, and I don't want to be the co-song leader for the last couple of lines. So I try to remember to stop singing, and two, not to embarrass my wife as well. But most of us know the importance. I've talked about it many times. You see it in Paul over and over again in his letters. The importance of faith, hope, and love. He mentions those three many times, numerous times, maybe most famously 1 Corinthians 13:13, but you find the same thing starting out 1 Thessalonians. You find the same thing in Thessalonians chapter 5. You find it in Colossians chapter 1. You find these three, faith, hope, and love, which we know are very important virtues in the Christian life. But one other virtue that I think that is right up there with those three as far as Christianity goes, that one of the most important qualities for us to have, according to the New Testament, is humility. That one of the characteristics of the true Christian or the true people of God is going to be humility. And this is emphasized many times in Jesus' teachings. I'm just going to give a few examples as I start out this morning before talking about it further. At the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, you have, of course, the Beatitudes. And the first three of those Beatitudes, one is, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. And blessed are the meek, for they shall gain the inheritance. And whatever else these first three Beatitudes mean, they make it clear that it is the humble and lowly who are going to be part of this coming kingdom that Jesus is inaugurating. The poor in spirit, the meek, the humble, those who mourn are going to be part of this kingdom. Last week, I finished up a series on the parables, and one of the parables we had looked at was the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector. And we're taught in that parable that it was the tax collector that wouldn't even look up to heaven and says to God, "Have mercy upon me, a sinner," who goes away justified rather than the Pharisee who thought he was better than other people. He says in verse 14, "I tell you, this man went down to his home justified rather than the other. For all who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted." And I think that humbled and that being exalted, the "will be," is talking about God. That if we humble ourselves, that God will raise us up. Again, I've said before, I don't think that the tax collector goes to the temple every day and says the same words every day. But he's coming to the temple on this specific day, and he realizes he needs to repent and that he needs to change. One of my favorite books outside the Bible is famous middle-aged writing, Thomas A. Kempis' Imitation of Christ. It was written in the Middle Ages by a Catholic at the time, a group of Catholics that were known for, you know, not just hiding away in you know, some sort of convent type setting or something, but they go out and give ministry to the poor and the downtrodden and things like that. But one of the themes that, and one of the reasons I really like the Imitation of Christ, is one of the things that Thomas really emphasizes his humility. And he makes the point a number of times, and I did not write down or quote any specific passage, but he says that we should look at our own sins and our own shortcomings first and be a whole lot slower to look at the sins and shortcomings of other people. That if anything else, we need to always be self-critical before we are critical of other people. And I think that fits so well with this parable that I'm talking about, the you know, or mention, the Pharisee and the tax collector, because the Pharisee, he thought he was doing good. Thank God I'm not like this other person over here. Whereas the tax collector, who was he looking at? He was looking at himself and his own shortcomings. And he had humility. He realized his own shortcomings rather than... And I think that's true. I think, you know, can we look and see error in other people? Yes, I think we can. But as Jesus says, before we remove the speck out of somebody else's eye, what do? We need to look first at the plank that is in our own eye, which, of course, that's kind of, you know, it's kind of a ludicrous picture, this person trying to go and take the speck out of somebody else's eye all the time he's walking around with like a log in his own eye. But, you know, but he's talking about human nature, and we tend to be more critical of others than we are ourselves, and it needs to be the other way around. We always need to look at ourselves first and realize our own shortcomings, our own weaknesses, our own mistakes, and it's only at that point that we can see clearly to look at other people. Jesus again emphasizes the same point about humility in Luke chapter 14, starting in verse 8. He says, when you're invited by someone to a wedding banquet, do not go and sit down in the place of honor in case someone more distinguished than you has been invited by your host, and the host who invited both of you may come and say to you, give this person your place, and then in disgrace you would start to take the lowest place. But he says, rather, when you're invited, go and sit down in the lowest place so that when your host comes, he may say to you, friend, come up here. You know, move up higher, sit a little closer. Then you will be honored in the presence of all who sit at the table with you. And again, this statement in Luke, for all who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. But Jesus is making it clear that if we want to be exalted by him, the first step to that is the step of humility. This importance of humility in the Christian life is also emphasized by the images that Jesus uses to tell us what we must be like to, one, to enter the kingdom, and two, to be great in the kingdom. The images he uses for what it means to be part of the kingdom of God is the image of slaves and the image of children. And I think to understand this, and I know, you know, of course, we're bothered by slavery and some of our history in the United States where it was primarily racial. Slaves in the first century would look very similar to people who were free men in the first century, and even people who were, you know, citizens in the first century. It wasn't by color of skin or anything like that. But slaves and children were those who had little to no status in the ancient world. In Matthew 18, it says, at that time the disciples came to Jesus and asked who is greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And he called a child who he put among them and said, truly I tell you, unless you change and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Verse 4, whoever becomes humble like this child is greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And a lot of times when people talk about these passages in the New Testament about children, I think we miss the context. It was very different today than now. We're in a society that really celebrates youth today. If you look, you know, your famous athletes are held up on pedestals, and most of them are in their 20s and 30s, you know, and 30 is oftentimes getting old for many athletes, you know, they're nearing the end of their career, so it's a lot of times in their 20s. And if you look at famous actresses and movie stars, we're all about appearances, we're all about looks, and so a lot of your famous movie stars are in their 20s. It was totally reversed in the ancient world. The people who had most status in the ancient world were those who were older, And the young people had little to no status. And so, you know, one, I think, is talking about that. And we, you know, we'll talk about a childlike faith, and maybe there's something to that. A humble faith, a childlike faith. But I think the main reason that Jesus uses the image of children is the same reason he uses the image of slaves, is that children had low status in the ancient world. You think about the setting. What do his disciples do when children are trying to come up to him? They stop them. Because children don't go before a famous rabbi. Children don't walk up and talk to a rabbi. And it's because of their status, and this is something that children do not do. And so he uses this imagery of low status. Both slaves and children had almost no status in the ancient world. And I think he uses children more than anything else to emphasize that we must become humble like children. But this is without a doubt what he's talking about when he talks about slave. When he talks about slaves, he says, you know, Mark chapter 10, you know that the Gentiles and those whom they recognize as their rulers lord it over them, and the great ones are tyrants over them. But he says to us, it is not so among you, but whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first among you must become slave of all. And what's our example? Verse 45 of Mark 10. For the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. If you want a commentary on Mark 10, verse 45, go to Philippians chapter 2, where he says, count others as more important than yourselves, and goes on and describes how Jesus left heaven and came to earth and became, you know, was lowly among men, and then he ultimately died upon a cross for you and me. I mean, this is the ultimate humiliation. If Jesus can leave heaven and come to earth and humble himself, then do you think we can practice humility towards each other and other people? But very clearly, one of the characteristics of Christianity is humility. We are called to be a humble people. And I think one characteristic of being a humble people or of humility has to do with God reliance and not self reliance. Chris read this morning from Genesis chapter 3, the story of the fall. And some may wonder, you know, sometimes reading Genesis chapter 3, you're wondering, well, why does God not want them to eat of the tree of knowledge of good and evil? And it's given that title if you go back to Genesis chapter 2. Now, you know, one of the sins there is obviously is God said not to eat it, which I understand is a good reason of not to eat it in and of itself. If God says don't do it, it's a pretty good idea not to do it. But I guess the question comes up, why did God not want them to eat of this tree? And I think of, after the discussion between Eve and the serpent, I think of verse chapter 6 when it's describing her deciding to partake of the fruit. It says in verse 6, so when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, so good food, which is definitely something, and that it was a delight to the eyes. And then I think this is the big one, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of the fruit and ate. And she also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate. And the eyes of both were opened. So in some sense, that's true. The tree did give some sort of knowledge of good and evil. The eyes of both were open, and they knew that they were naked. And so she saw in this fruit, she saw it was desired to make one wise, as the serpent had told her. And some might wonder, well, is this wisdom a good thing or a bad thing? You know, obviously other places in scriptures, you know, really presents wisdom as a good thing. In Proverbs, wisdom, you know, if you go to Proverbs, of course, in Proverbs, wisdom has to do with morality and is looked at as a very good thing. And if that's so, why is partaking of the tree of knowledge of good and evil a bad thing for Adam and Eve to do? And my understanding of it is the tree is not about wisdom in what we would consider godly wisdom that leads to morality. It's really about them, about who is going to guide our path. Are we as humans, and in this case, Adam and Eve,